Can I ask you something? What's your family story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams, your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up, we record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded. Welcome back to the Vietnamese Podcast with Kevin. And we today are biting off a huge chunk of Vietnamese history here. We should have done this a long time ago. We talked about doing it a while back ago, but this is a big topic. It's Hai Ba Trưng, aka the Trưng sisters, and they are a huge inspiration for women all over Vietnam,
and not just all over Vietnam, but around the world. I mean, when you think of Vietnam in the global anti-imperial, anti-colonial imagination, the Trưng sisters immediately come up, and this is for people all around the world.
Yeah, but there are some historical inaccuracies, I feel, that were embellished throughout the years, such as where they actually died, or did they actually die, or were they captured? All of these things, I think, are, they play in the kind of the folklore. And I'm, you know, I hear different conflicting things all the time. So I definitely am looking forward to all of the details that you're going to bring to the table today. And in fact, I know that this took a lot of time, especially this episode taking a lot of time. So would you do the honors about the donation?
Yeah. So listeners, I take time off of my work to do this. And so we would appreciate donations. I work at a cafe, so you could feel free to buy me a coffee with the super thanks on YouTube. And that would be really appreciated. So thank you very much. Okay, so today we're going to ask ourselves a few questions. Who are the Trưng sisters? And why are they important? Do you remember when the first time you heard of the Trưng sisters?
Yeah, I think it was when I was in Vietnam and there's a Hai Ba Trưng street. And I think that was like, for me, the first time I heard of it. I didn't hear about Hai Ba Trưng growing up. I didn't know anything about Hai Ba Trưng. I didn't hear my mom and dad talk about it. But I'm guessing that is a new street that was added to Saigon. I could be wrong, but they never talked about it. And when I got there, I was like, okay, this must be some heroic people to have the street named after both of them.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I remember hearing about them since I was a little kid from my uncles. They would say, do you know about Hai Ba Trưng? They fought the Chinese. They defeated the Chinese. And so they're everywhere. And so real quick, for listeners who might not know, the Trưng sisters are famous for leading an army of around 80,000 people to rebel against the Chinese who were dominating the Vietnamese. And this was around the year 40 AD. So like more than 2,000 years ago, right? And so, and the Trưng sisters then become leaders, like the first monarchs, the first women monarchs of a sovereign state for about 2 to 3 years. But then they are then defeated by the returning Chinese who come back. And so that's what they did. And they're so important because they are national heroes. They are really, you might even go so far as to say that they give birth to the idea of Vietnam. I mean, yes, there was a sense of Vietnamese national identity maybe before that, but really it is through the Zheng sisters that we have this idea that the Vietnamese have a national identity of their own, one that is different from the Chinese. You know, that is what makes the Vietnamese different. Here's evidence of resistance. So it gets incorporated into popular imagination today. Let's remind ourselves that all national identities are actually myths. That's probably going to upset some people for me to say that, but it's a fact, right? All national identity and nationalism is an invention. All national identities, you know, what it means to be French, what it means to be American or Chinese or Vietnamese. The fact is that our past, human history, is so complicated with so many different groups fighting each other and everything. So this idea of a unified nation is actually something quite new. And then we tell ourselves stories to make that solid, you know, that national identity.
When I started Vid History Makers with you, I feel like I was always trying to get at the root of, are we Chinese? Did we come from the Chinese? I think that question is stale now, as we are here today with Haibat Zheng. And I think that you bring up a really good point. It's like, there's a line of demarcation, but it doesn't have to necessarily be, were they Vietnamese trying to kick out the Chinese? It's just, I think, groups of people fighting for their independence or fighting for their space. And whatever it was called at the time, probably not as important as the two people who we're about to talk about today.
Yeah. So before we go into the story of the Zheng sisters, let's give some context, because that's one of the important things about this episode, because I have to admit, I'm stepping away from my expertise of the French colonial period. So we're going to go towards the Chinese colonial period. And let me stop right there. Some people are going to say, wait a second, Kevin, you should not use the word colonialism to describe Chinese domination over Vietnam. It was something else. I remember one time I had called it Chinese colonialism, and somebody, I think they were from China, they got upset. They said, no, China did not colonize Vietnam like the Europeans did. Vietnam was simply a part of China. And my response in my mind is, okay, how would Vietnamese people see it? You know, would they say, oh yeah, we were a part of China? No, we hear that language that from Vietnamese people that China dominated the Vietnamese, right? That China ruled over the Vietnamese, right? We hear that. And so the context here is the Chinese Han Dynasty. So this was the second Chinese dynasty, the second imperial Chinese dynasty. So right before the Han Dynasty, you had the Qin Dynasty, which existed for only about 15 years from 221 BC to 2000, it's 206 BC. That's the Qin Dynasty. Before that, China was just chaos. Like, there were different groups fighting each other. And then it was the Qin Dynasty that unifies everything. And that itself is pretty interesting, because before the Qin Dynasty, you had different schools of thought in China, like Confucianism, you had the legalists, you had the followers of Mozi, and all these different ideas about what is good governance, what is the good life. They're all fighting each other, and different warlords would compete. But then you have the Qin Dynasty that unifies everything, and that lasts for only 15 years. And then you have the Han Dynasty, which is from 206 BC to 220 AD, so about 400 years, right? And this is the dynasty that dominates the Vietnamese, what we consider to be the northern part of Vietnam today. So what the Han Dynasty, or what a particular kingdom does, is that they incorporate today's North Vietnam into their southern lands. And this area, North Vietnam, was called Jiaozi. And I probably mispronounced that, by the way, Jiaozi, maybe? Mm-hmm. J-I-A-O-Z-H-I. But it's around the Red River Delta. And so why did the Chinese come here? Why did they rule? Well, they wanted a place to launch boats from so that they could do trade with India and the Middle East. And so let me quote from Christopher Gosha's book, He quotes a Chinese administrator in Jiaozi, and the administrator says, "This place is famous for precious rarities from afar. Pearls, incense, drums, elephant tusks, rhinoceros horns, tortoise shells, coral, lapis, lazuli, parrots, kingfishers, peacocks, rare and abundant treasure enough to satisfy all desires. So it's not necessary to depend on what is received from regular taxes in order to profit the central kingdom." So the point is that this was a place of trade, you know? So it was very valuable for the Chinese. So that's partly why they wanted to go there. And the Chinese Empire would also bring Chinese Han administrators and officers and settlers there. So there were some settlers. So you could probably call it colonialism. I mean, colonialism simply means literally a farmer, like somebody who controls the land. That have you seen? I think I talked about this before. Have you seen the movie The Martian?
Yeah, I have.
Matt Damon.
That's a colony.
So Matt Damon. What's that?
That's a colony, right? You send one person up and.
So Matt Damon, he grows potatoes on Mars, and then he tells his people, "Look, I'm the first to colonize Mars," because he's the first to farm. So that's what colonialism means. It means directly controlling the land. Now. But at the same time, I do agree with people who say it's not quite colonialism. It's more imperialist control. So imperialism is often understood as extending power. It's not directly controlling land. So anyway, but there were some settlers, Chinese settlers. There weren't too many of them. But the point here is that many Han authorities had no choice but to accommodate local Vietnamese leaders, because like there aren't too many Chinese, you know, so you need help from the locals. And so what do? They give them a role in administration. So that's how you get collaborators.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now I'm wanting to constantly clarify with you or ask you, the people that were in that area trying to kind of live life at the time were not called Vietnamese people yet. Were they not labeled anything yet? They were just people who probably wanted independence to live the way they want and not pay the taxes, maybe the exorbitant taxes that the Chinese, the Han dynasty was kind of imposing, right? It's you know, and then our modern society, our modern national sort of identity in Vietnam says, okay, well, we need to take that narrative of these two sisters and then bring it and then just define it because it's in our geographic sort of domain.
Exactly. And that's what we're going to talk more about later. Exactly. So one point that I want to make here is that it's true that there was resistance to Chinese imperial expansion. That's true. But at the same time, it's also true that many Vietnamese people wanted to just build a better life from within the Chinese empire. And often you had marginalized groups who saw a chance with the Chinese empire. They're like, oh, maybe we can reassert ourselves with the new powerful Chinese coming in. You know, you see this happen all the time, actually. You know, when the Spanish came to the Latin America or the New World, some of the groups of tribes and people who were dominated by the Aztecs and the Incas saw an opportunity, right, to ally with the Spanish. So anyway, so the point is that there were some people who saw an opportunity here with the Chinese. So there was another thing that the Han Chinese brought to this region, which was culture, certain new cultural ideas, technology, military technology, modernity, ways of doing government. And a lot of this was attractive, especially when it could be used to promote local interests and trade. You know, people are using these Chinese things. And so the point here is that there was quite a lot of collaboration. I mean, come on. The Chinese dominate the Vietnamese for 1,000 years. Obviously, the Vietnamese are not resisting the whole time, right? Obviously, it worked out for quite some time.
Hey, them are fighting words, Kevin.
I know, right? So we hear this trope that, oh, the Vietnamese kicked out the Chinese. Yeah, but for 1,000 years, they were really embracing, for example, things like Chinese legal codes, Chinese calendars, Chinese systems of measurement of weights and maps and statecraft and weapons and paper and Chinese characters, the writing systems. So you also have thousands of Chinese settlers moving into this area, and they're bringing in new ideas, new words. So we talk about language. A lot of Chinese words are entering the Vietnamese language at this time. And then one of the most important things is Confucianism. And we've talked about this a lot throughout the series. But one interesting thing is that Confucianism was mostly happening in the urban areas. So among the educated Vietnamese elites, right? The educated class, the educated men, mostly. And there are also, however, with all that, what you might call good stuff, like language, technology, there's also labor requirements and heavy taxation. So it was a tributary system. So the Vietnamese had to pay tribute or taxes in order to receive China's protection, right? So now we're getting to how the Chung sisters rebel. So what happened? Now, often there were resistance movements breaking out whenever the Chinese imperial court tried to impose direct rule instead of relying on Vietnamese collaborators. So, or when they were taxing them too much. And so we're going to talk about that in a moment. But I'm going to say what happened quickly, and then we'll go more into it. But basically, the Chung sisters, they revolt in around year 39 or year 40 AD. Why? Do you know why?
I can't remember. No.
You don't remember? So the immediate cause was that one of the sisters, so there are two sisters, Chung Chak and oh my God, why, and the other one, Chung Chak and Chung Yi. So Chung Chak's husband was a local lord. His name was Ti Sak, and he was executed by the Chinese governor for opposing Chinese policies. And apparently the husband also might have plotted with other Vietnamese to overthrow the Chinese, maybe. But anyway, the Chinese were upset with the husband and executed him. And so Chung Chak wanted to get revenge.
That makes sense.
That was the start of the rebellion.
Yep.
Does that surprise you that was the reason for the initial rebellion?
No, because when you think about something like that, that event has implications. It has deep historical implications. And what I mean by that is you just don't go and kill somebody. Like, the government of China doesn't just go and kill somebody. And then the revenge of the wife just doesn't happen, right? There's buildup to that. There's a lot of probably historical events that led up to that. And that momentum that needs to happen and carry out the revenge, all of that needs to sort of take place. So that doesn't surprise me one bit.
Yeah. Well, when I first heard it, like, I was kind of like, wait a second. I thought the women rebelled because they didn't like the Chinese, but then now it's always about a man, you know? But I think you're right. So this was all happening during a series of unpopular assimilation policies aimed at this elite class. And so also, when more Han settlers would move in, this would also trigger revolts because they would remove some of the local Vietnamese elites from their power, right? So you have to imagine that you're an elite Vietnamese man. The Chinese gave you power, they gave you position, right? But then some other Chinese settlers come in, they kick you out. Like, you're not upset at Chinese imperialism, actually. You benefit from it. Yeah. You're upset because your position was taken, right? And so what happens is the Chung sisters, they revolt, they quickly take control of about 65 citadels in northern Vietnam. And then they establish themselves as rulers.
See, and then that doesn't just happen. 65 citadels. I mean, you need to like motivate and bring together troops and have a plan of attack. I mean, who's to say that Jung Jack didn't organize this all for her husband, and her husband was the one who got put to death because he's, you know, it was probably a patriarchal society. But the mastermind was always her. And then she was able to mobilize all these, you know, to take over all these citadels. So I think it's years in the making when you think about these relationships.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll talk more about what that was like for them, because I want to turn to the book, Bronze Drum, which you interviewed the author, I think, right? Feng Wen.
Yeah. Yeah,
we'll talk more about that in a moment. But basically, what I want to say, though, is that they hold power for about 2 to 3 years. And then in 43 AD, the Chinese emperor dispatches a famous general named Ma Yuan, and he ends the revolt and then reinstates Chinese power. And then the sisters are defeated. Eventually, they're captured, and eventually they commit suicide.
That's a big question of contention too. Have you heard about that? About the pushback on? Well,
no.
In legend that they jumped off a specific cliff in Vietnam, in northern Vietnam, but there is a festival in China, in the southern part of China, that celebrates the killing of the sisters.
Hmm. Oh.
Yeah.
Interesting. So let's another thing that I want to talk about, you had mentioned the word patriarchy. This is really interesting. So we're going to talk about that. But before we go into that, I do want to say again for the listener that I enjoyed the novel Bronze Drum by Feng Wen, and it's really the first imagined narrative of the Chung sisters in English, and it came out just 3 years ago, 2022, by Grand Central Publishing. Shout out to Feng. But he tells this imagined story. And so for the rest of this episode, I'm actually going to be inspired by that. I'm just going to draw on that. Because the fact is, it's like this happened 2,000 years ago. And we
really don't.
Yeah. It's all guesswork. And so what we can do is just go with Feng's novel. I mean, I think he does a fun, good job of it. Let's do that. Okay, now a few other things to mention. The research of Feng's novel, Bronze Drums, is largely informed by somebody else that you have interviewed.
My dear friend, Nam Si Kim.
Yes. So he's an archaeologist, an anthropological archaeologist at UW Madison. He studies the Golua Citadel built around the 3rd century BC. In today's Hanoi, and the significance of the citadel is that it essentially tells us that there was a polity, like a Vietnamese civilization there, and this era is known as the Lac Viet era. It's also known as the Dong Sơn era, and the famous thing about this era is that it's the Vietnamese Bronze Age, and so which basically means that there was a lot of use of bronze. And so this is the bronze drum. That is the symbol of being Vietnamese, right? The bronze drum. See it everywhere. And today you see people with tattoos of bronze drums, you know.
Motifs, yeah.
So you've seen this everywhere, right? So I showed it to my brother, who's a tattoo artist. And I was asking him, Alan, can you come up with a tattoo design? Check out this, like, indigenous Vietnamese bronze drum. And he was surprised because he was like, this doesn't look Chinese at all. Like, if you look at the birds and the symbols, it almost looks like Polynesian. Mm-hmm. No. So the point here is that there's a distinct Vietnamese identity that's different from Chinese identity. And the bronze drum is also really significant because what are these drums? Number one, so people say that there are different uses for them. They were used in war. So the drums were used for battle formations. It's like bang three times, move left, you know, like used to communicate. And And so they were decorated with carvings of animals, seabirds, and scenes of fishing and daily life. And one interesting thing is that when the Han invaders came in, there's a story that they wanted to melt all of the bronze drums to create these big columns to symbolize Chinese power. And one thing that the Vietnamese people did to resist was hide the bronze drums. And that was an act of resistance. That's the first act of resistance, you know, hiding the bronze drums. And that's why we find so many of them today. Like, isn't that kind of amazing story?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Fascinating story.
And then we see so many of them being dug up, and it's a symbol of Vietnamese resistance. So this is like the seed of resistance. I mean, I get kind of chills hearing about it. You know, this is how it goes down to the power of nationalism here. So anyway, the book is interesting because it portrays this interesting dynamic between the two sisters, Chung Chak and Chung Yi. They have different characters. So basically, and it's quite symbolic because Chung Chak is wise and disciplined. But Chung Yi is impulsive and empathetic. So it's kind of like yin and yang, you know, like two halves of a whole. And so the story is about the tensions between them. And there are a few themes here. So one major theme is gender. And within that, a few other things that I want to talk about. So one thing that I was struck about from the book was the anti-Confucianism of it. So let's talk about matriarchy. Ken, do you know of any matriarch societies?
I don't off the top of my head, but I know that there's a few. I think my guess was Egypt at some point in their history, matriarchy society.
Yeah, so for the listener, patriarchy means rule by men. Matriarchy means rule by women. And so one interesting thing that I read in is that it was Cham society that was matriarchal. Cham society was matrilocal. So this is when married couples live near the wife's family. Like, that's not today's Vietnamese society. It's patrilocal, right? Like, for example, my own family in San Jose, like, the couple was expected to live near the father's family, like, you know, live near the husband's family, right? Not live near the mother's family,
right?
So it's matrilocal. It's also matrilinear. So you trace your lineage through the mother, not the father. That's Cham society. It's matrilinear.
The Jewish old biblical is traced through your mother. Jewish lineage is traced through your mom.
Right. So one interpretation, and maybe others will give other interpretations, but one interpretation is that it's the Cham society and Cham culture that played an important part in forming the culture of Vietnam, which helped the Vietnamese resist the Confucian ideology, which was patriarchal.
Mm.
So it's thanks to the Cham that the Vietnamese kept their matrilinear or matriarchal tendencies. Maybe, right? It's all speculation. But this is also perhaps a reason why in China we see foot binding, right, of Chinese women, but we don't see that in Vietnam.
Right.
So this kind of patriarchy, it is not as successful in Vietnam, especially among peasant women who are further away from the Confucian influence. So in the novel, you get these moments where, for example, the parents of the Chung sisters, the father says to the wife, "Who will protect them?" And then the wife goes, "Oh, you speak like a Confucian, you know, like they need protection or something." And so we see this matriarchy in the novel. So I think that's really interesting there.
But is it truly a women led warrior society? Because in the artwork, you see the two sisters, you know, geared up in military battle gear. And, you know, that just doesn't sound, I don't know, historically accurate in my mind. So were we a female warrior society at the time? Or did these two ladies just, you know, they kind of like pulled a Joan of Arc to lead the rebellion, and they were the masterminds, the brains behind the men, you know, the warrior men?
Yeah.
Which was...
That's a good question. I just remember, I'm thinking of one moment in the novel that I liked where there was a village where the sisters were trying to motivate the villagers to join in the rebellion. But all the villagers would say, no, come on, there's no way we can defeat the Chinese. Like, they're like gods, you know, they're so powerful. But at the same time, there was a tiger in the village that kept like eating people. And so what the sisters do is they come up with a plan to kill the tiger. And by doing that, they show the people that it's possible to take things into your own hands.
Yeah, you know, use your brains.
It's possible to kill or defeat what you think is insurmountable.
Right.
And I thought that, and then once the villagers realized that it was capable to kill a tiger, then they could fight the Chinese. But one interesting thing about the question of how much power women had in this time is that there are arguments by historians who say that, okay, even though the Vietnamese adopted Confucian ideology, if we look at the Lê dynasty, for example, which is from the 15th to 18th century, women had more rights. Like, they had equal inheritance rights. They could own property. And if there was no son, then they could keep the extra land for ancestor worship. And that these rights were kept in place by different emperors all the way until the 18th century. So there's like a history of women's rights, essentially, much more than China. Anyway, yeah.
It's still mind-blowing to me, any society in the world. And I know we live in a modern, you know, American, Western world where, you know, if you own the land, it doesn't matter if you're man or woman, you own the land. Or if you have the money or you own property, whoever's name it's in, it's just so mind-blowing to me how these societies back in the day can just assign and allocate, oh, that just belongs to the men. And everything is, you know, handed down from the men's side, from your last name to your property to your money. It's just so crazy to think about, like, societies back in the day.
Yeah. I mean, you're making me think of the French Revolution, where the French Revolution famously fights for the 99%, which is the third estate. And you know, that is the first time when people are talking about liberty, equality, and fraternity. And then they created the French Declaration of the Rights of Citizen and the Man. But there's a very famous woman, Olympe de Gouges, who writes it for women. So she says, okay, you're doing a revolution, but women need these rights. You know, like, the revolution is just for the men. That doesn't make any sense. And so she essentially reproduces the list of rights that the men wrote. And she says, the women need this too. Yeah. And this reminds me of the American Revolution, where Frederick Douglass, the famous black abolitionist, he gives a famous speech called to the slave, what is the 4th of July? What is the 4th of July to the slave? And he's praising the Americans. He says, you did a beautiful revolution. I love it. But all of you are turning your backs on our founding fathers because they had these ideals and you're not following through on them. So anyway, there is a history of marginalized peoples telling revolutionaries, look, you're being hypocrites. You need to extend these ideals to everybody. But one thing that really shines through in Feng Nguyen's novel is this idea of choice for the women. So, for example, there's a moment in the novel where the mother of the sister says, "Our daughters are safe from the Han." And I'm quoting here, "If the time comes, they will know to take their lives rather than to have it taken from them by an enemy. If you are born to die by your own hand, then you have nothing to fear from war." I think that's, what are you taking that
for? I love it. There's a sense of independence regardless. You know, there's a spirit of independence that's like etched inside of their DNA that gives them complete agency over their lives.
Yeah. So the mother says that, and then in the novel it says, "These words rang and echoed in Zheng Yi's ears." So you could see the mother, promoting these sorts of values, and then the sisters adopting it. Another thing I found interesting in the novel was this distinction between women and men. And so, for example, one of the sisters says, "Our war is not a war for bloodthirsty men to tear each other apart. Ours is a war to restore justice. No woman would fight for the sake of the fight, and every one of us is in it for the cause." I don't know.
That's such a modern spin.
It is, right? It is a modern spin. This is definitely Feng taking some liberties of interpretation here.
Yeah. And I've always thought of sort of language and thought and culture as strata of technologies. They're like layers of ways people approach things. And when you give agency like that, handed down from your mom, that's a certain privilege that we enjoy today as, as Western thought, or in hindsight, we're like looking at different cultures throughout the history. And you can only assign that in modern day. Like that's a thought that modern day peoples can have. Because I think slavery up to 200 years ago was rampant, right? That was like another technology, quote unquote, to like free people who are, are like domestic animals to certain groups of people. That's like what? That's a new thought.
You're bringing up a really important point that I want to talk briefly here, and it's slightly moving away from the topic, but it's definitely still relevant. And it's about the idea of freedom. We've been talking about this idea of freedom, and there are several historians who argue that the concept of freedom is strictly a Western concept because it comes from the Greeks and the Romans. You did not have the concept of freedom outside of Greece and Rome because of one reason. It was only in Greece and Rome that you had large-scale slavery. You have slavery all over the world, that's to be sure. But it was only in Greece and Rome where their entire economies were dependent on slaves. And so it was only in that condition where the concept of freedom is even possible, because the whole, what freedom is because you know what slavery is because it's in your society, right? So that's why you value freedom. It's kind of like if today, if we imagine that there's a lot of homeless people, then suddenly having a home becomes a value. Right? Then you would go around saying, "Oh, I am home full. I have a home," as opposed to being homeless. But in ancient Greece and Rome, the economies depended on slavery. And so slaves would always be inspired to work. Why were slaves motivated in ancient Greece? What could motivate a slave to keep on working hard? Can you give a guess, Ken?
I don't know. Maybe just basic survival, food, shelter. The chance for freedom?
Yes. The promise of freedom. The promise of freedom. That is what motivated many slaves in ancient Greece and Rome. And you could watch the movie Gladiator to see this too. You know, it's like someday you will be free. And so freedom becomes a really cherished thing. It's called manumission. So this promise of freedom. And this is a fascinating thought because like the word for freedom. So Orlando Patterson has a very famous book called Slavery and Social Death, where he talks about this Western idea of freedom. But like he had his students try to come up like the word for freedom, where does it show up in Asian languages, for example? And the conclusion he comes up with is that yes, but only through Western influence. Because when you had Westerners go around trying to make dictionaries of Chinese words or whatever, or Asian languages, like they would say, okay, hey, do you have a word for cat? And then the Chinese person would be like, oh yeah, it's this. Or the Vietnamese person would say, oh yeah, it's this. But when you had concepts, they would go, do you have a word for freedom? And then they would go, oh yeah, irresponsibility, selfishness, licentiousness. You know, like it just didn't exist in their vocabulary because it's not a concept. Now, to be sure, there's slavery all over the world, but it's mostly domestic slavery. You know, you have a slave to do your chores and stuff, but like it was really in Greece and Rome where you had economies dependent on slavery. So the argument is that freedom becomes a Western idea. Anyway, I think this is interesting here and relevant to talk about. Because this notion of freedom, right, comes from when there's a feeling of oppression. And so the Vietnamese began to feel oppressed when the Chinese began to tax them more than usual, for example, or when they began to take away their power. So here, what word would you use to describe what the Zheng sisters did? Is it resistance? Is it rebellion? Is it revolution? Do you think it's a revolution?
No, not quite. I think a revolution is a little different, maybe. And I think resistance and rebellion is more, I think, along the right spirit of their action.
Yeah. So I think it first started as a desire for revenge. So in the novel, at least, one of the sisters says, tomorrow I am no longer a widow. I am an instrument of revenge. Tisak may be but a ghost and a memory, but I am now his tooth and claw in this world. So it starts off with anger at the husband being killed. And then they channel that grief into rage and their pain into action. And they blame the Han. And so then they move that to this feeling of our people. It's a fight for our people. So our people are not property, I'm quoting. And the story and there's only one response, outrage at the injustice of living under such a people, the Han. So there's a moment in the novel that actually triggers this whole thing. And I think it was pretty interesting. So one of the tax collectors, one of the representatives of the Han, says, hey, we were able to collect taxes and it exceeded our projections by 12%. And this is troubling. And then one of the administrators goes, troubling? What are you talking about? It's 12% greater than projected. But then the governor says, that's what troubles me, quote, it means our expectations are too low. In the future, projections and yield should match perfectly. If you come in too low, then you might be skimming. If you come in too high, then that implies we could have asked for more. The solution is simple. We just raise taxes by 12%. So that's what like sparks it off. Right?
Was that historically accurate or did Feng...
I have no idea, you know.
We got to ask.
Maybe. But I love that because it shows how like these little things, you know, like anti-colonial struggle is not this like big like fighting. It happens because of like personal like offenses, yeah. You know. Also like the structures of power. So I like how it's done in the book. Another thing I found interesting was that Tisak, the husband, before he was killed, they were talking about writing letters to the Chinese Han, like, please don't do this, you know, like before they get violent, they're going to say, like, look, we're loyal, we're good, you don't need to do this. We write a list of demands, right? And we see this through history so often, like the Declaration of Independence. And I think I've said this on the show, but if you're an American, you need to read the Declaration of Independence, because it's really just a list of
demands.
A list of grievances, you know, like, here are all our grievances, and it's a list. And the point of the list is to justify violence. Because you say, look, it's not just one thing. If you responded to maybe three of our grievances, like, what? So the question is, when is rebellion justified? When do you have the right to use violence to fight the authorities? Like, let me ask you, Ken, like, I mean, that's a relevant question for today. Do you know, like, when can the masses of people be justified in using violence against their government? What?
Wow, this is such a good question that I think about never. I never think about this. And the reason why I answer that way is because I think, when I think about society, and I think about the less I see of military people in uniform or people in uniform period as police or people with guns, the less I see of that, the better. And I don't see much of that, like, in my everyday life. And if I don't see it, then I don't think there's a need for rebellion. Now, here's when I think that there's a need for this. We are living in it right now. When there are agents that just show up and pull people out of, you know, and these are perfectly aligned American citizens that look a certain way, people of color, that are just being pulled because of the way they look. That does require people pouring out into the streets in big numbers. You just can't do that. So I think when it really crosses the line in a way that you're being picked off because of the way you look or your socioeconomic status and you're being oppressed, I mean, it is very apparent that this is happening. I think at that point, you should be able to resist and rebel.
Okay, but hold on now, though. Let's say, okay, if you see injustice happening, then yes, you can protest in the streets, you can hold signs. But my real question, though, was when are you justified in using violence to overthrow the government? You know, the protest thing is just people saying, hey, follow the laws, follow the Constitution. But my question was, when are you justified in overthrowing violently the government? And the point I want to get across is that it's really actually hard to debate this philosophically. So there's a whole school of thought called just war theory. When are you justified in going to war with another country? And that's actually a little clearer. Like, there are criteria, like, it's, you've exhausted all the options, you have the right authority, you consult the United Nations, etc. But the problem with doing a revolution, like, when is it okay to do a revolution, is because, number one, who gets to authorize the revolution? Let's say one dude says, hey, everybody, I'm the real revolutionary, follow me. But then another guy says, no, follow me, I'm the real revolution. Like, how do you know which person to follow? You know?
This is a multi-pronged answer. I think when I think about, and this is something I posted during that time, it was the George Floyd era. And I don't know if it was a mistake, but this is how I felt at the time. And looking back, I'm not sure if I still feel the same, but I posted, burn the city down. And that's what I posted on my Facebook page. Burn the city down. And I feel like when you put your knee on somebody's neck and you kill them, and the governing body of the city is like, oh, that's okay, we're going to exonerate the four officers that killed that man. I think that's when you should show, as a community, as a people, to burn the city down. That's just me. And that's me being prior military. That's me being believing in, you know, the orderly lives of civilians in America. But when you kill somebody and there's no repercussions from the government for the officers that perpetrated that, I think that there needs to be some serious repercussions.
So this is great that you bring this up, because one question on the minds of every revolutionary is, how do we channel our anger into productive political and social projects? Half of it is the destruction. Good, yes, destroy what is bad, destroy
it.
Burn it down, but you can't just stop there. You can't only, but you need to build something in its place. You need to build a new world. So the question then becomes, what kind of world do you build? What kind of vision do you have for the future? Burning things down is not enough. Like any revolutionary who actually wants to channel mass anger into a project that actually changes the world for a better needs to have a vision. So yes, burn it down, but how are you going to build it back up?
And we talked about that in the Nguyen-Xu episode. We're like, oftentimes, you said oftentimes dictators will rise up from a revolution, but they're repeating the same thing that the predecessors did too.
Exactly. So often revolutionaries end up reproducing the bad of the old society. So the question is, how do you, and this is good to bring up now, because what happens is that the Cheng sisters defeat the Chinese and the Chinese retreat, and now they have power. So then what do? And this part of the novel, the Bronze Drums novel, is really interesting, because we see that it becomes really difficult for the sisters, because they were focused during the war. But now that they have independence, they don't really know how to run a government, right? How to run everyday life, how to make freedom last. So I'm going to quote from the novel. It says, "Free at last from the yoke of the Han, the men and women of Lak Viet began to see oppression in the subtlest of signals of their new rulers. Politics exhausted her more than war ever could." And he says, "Wealth and independence do not make happiness, as long as that happiness can be measured against one's neighbors." So the point is, like, after you get independence, you're confronted with all these new problems of running a society. And I'm really glad.
Yeah, and is it better than paying heavy taxes and being abused by your government?
Yeah. So what kind of society are you going to build? You know, so I'm really glad that Feng brought this part of the dilemma for revolutionaries in, because ultimately, you know, were they really revolutionary? No, because they did not imagine a new form of governing. They merely replaced who was in power. And so the real revolutionaries are the communist revolutionaries, because they are going to imagine a new way of organizing society. The real revolutionaries are the American revolutionaries, moving from a monarchy to a republic or a democracy. Now, I have to preface that, because some will say the American revolution was not a revolution, because who was in power before? Rich, propertied men. Who is in power after? Rich, propertied men, right? Is it really a revolution? But of course, you could still say that, yeah, it was, because before you had a monarchy, and now you have a totally different way of thinking about human relationships.
You know, as we're discussing these things week after week, I think about what the actual Vietnamese citizen in America, in Vietnam, are thinking. What do Vietnamese nationals think about our discussion? And I'd love to hear it in the comments. And please let us know if you are a Vietnamese national, and your take on our discussion, because this discussion is two people who are who've grown up outside of the Vietnamese world, you know, and we are using English to describe only thoughts that we are now thinking about. But I think if you grew up in the school system in Vietnam, this is going to be a totally different conversation. And I don't even know if we're really talking about the same thing. They might have other historical details that we're not privy to. And we're pulling from Fung, you know, who is an American professor, university. And also
Christopher Gosha, the very eminent historian of Vietnam as well.
Yeah. But, you know, I think it's fair game that we are talking about Hai Bat-Chung in this context, because we're coming from a from an outsider's point of view, analyzing something that's inside of our cultural DNA. But it can't possibly be the same as somebody who's, because I can't imagine people in Vietnam growing up having the same exact thought of Hai Bat-Chung as well, because 2000 years ago, the written records were not there. So it's right. This is all fair game.
Yeah. I agree.
I do want to talk a little bit more about this idea of, were they, do you know if they were actually taken off to China, abducted?
I mean, my understanding is that they committed suicide rather than cave into the returning Chinese general Ma Yuan. So they come back, they take over. So this was a very short-lived rebellion and period of sovereignty. As we know, so the Chinese dominate Vietnam from 111 BC to 938 AD. And then they come back in the 15th century. So this is, about the Chinese question, I don't know. But, you know,
yeah,
do you think that's significant?
Think it's significant because
why?
If you rest your power in this idea of agency, then jumping off a cliff is clearly agency, right? It's your decision. You made a decision to kill yourself. And just like the five generals that we talked about in the past, you have powers in your own hands. But if you are taken away and beheaded in the south of China somewhere, then I think it totally changes.
Oh, beheaded.
Or
that is not the story that that I typically see. I mean, it's a suicide.
Yeah, I'm throwing in beheaded, but they were killed somewhere in southern China. And there's a festival that happens every year that really, you know, eerily resembles the Hai Bat-Chung sister coming up from Vietnam or being captured. In Vietnam. I really need to know more about this. We should have Namsi Kim back on to talk about the history of the Hai Bat-Chung sister. We might have that as a companion piece to this, and or maybe get Nam in and discuss it. You know, I really do appreciate the political side and the historical side that you bring to this conversation, because it's something that that we all know and we all hear. Every time we go back to Vietnam, there's that Hai Bat-Chung street, and it's both in the south, in Saigon and in Hanoi.
Yeah. I mean, I remember, I think there was one historian who went so far as to say that, would there even have been a Vietnam if it weren't for Hai Bat-Chung? You know, like at least for the story, the power that the story has. I mean, I remember being a tiny kid and hearing about this story. And if you think about all this Chinese culture that is being infused in Vietnamese society, like, what is it really that distinguishes the Vietnamese from the Chinese? It's this act of rebellion, you know? And then, so then you have that story of the Vietnamese resisting the Chinese and resisting the French, resisting the Japanese, resisting the Americans. It becomes all part of a big story. You know?
I thought about that in the first 10 minutes of our episode today. What makes us different as Vietnamese people than Chinese people? You know, and there's all sorts of like shallow generalities that we could talk about, you know, things that we could differentiate on a very shallow level between our cultures and the way we outwardly present.
I have an answer that I personally would give to that, which is that the difference between generally Vietnamese people and Chinese people is that if you were to take a time machine to the 1920s and ask Chinese people, do you have an indigenous intellectual tradition that you're proud of? The Chinese would say, yes, of course. We have Confucius, we have Mencius, we have Mozi, we have... But if you were to ask the Vietnamese that, they would say, no, we take it from the Chinese. But the one difference is that the Vietnamese are very proud of their ability to hybridize and to mix from different cultures and to create something new. We see this in what Phan Quyen says about Nguyễn Du. Like Nguyễn Du essentially plagiarizes, even though that I think that's an anachronistic term. Like he takes it, the tale of Qiu from a Chinese novel, but he totally redoes it into something better. And I think that is a distinctly Vietnamese thing to do. Like you wouldn't hear Chinese people say, oh yeah, we proudly mix together French and, you know, Vietnamese and to make something new. No, I think that's something that the Vietnamese do.
So today, have we answered this idea of at what point is revolting and resisting okay? Is that the question that we were thinking about when we reflect back on the Haibachung sisters?
I think that's a really good question that it's always a debate. One thing that the Americans show us is, and what John Locke, the philosopher, shows us is that you need a long train of abuses. You need to show that there has been a long train of abuses and that you have repeatedly asked nicely for justice, but you keep getting ignored. And then finally, you're justified in using violence.
Wow.
But then you have to think about the justice in war. So jus in bello in Latin, like what are you justified in doing? Like what kind of violence are you justified in using? You know, if the government is disappearing people, are you allowed to kill a lot of people? You know, like how many? Or and also you have to think about the justice after war, used post bellum. So how can you create a just society after that? You need to think about that as well.
And you know, these questions are so relevant when I'm watching, like I'm literally watching ICE agents on the streets of LA, on the social media and on TV. And I'm going, wow, like where do we draw lines here?
Yeah. And also what tactics are justified? And you also have to think about, you know, what is effective as well. So, these are hard questions that we're always confronted with.
Thank you today, Kevin. This is, I knew Haibachung, the sisters would provoke political thought and direction from you. But it's kind of fitting during this time right now in Los Angeles, especially. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.